From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Kate Ellis is someone who knows a lot about the culture at Parliament House. She was elected at the age of 27 as Labor member for the seat of Adelaide in 2004 and became a minister in 2007. She held a number of portfolios, including youth and sport, early childhood education, and employment participation. As a young woman, she was particularly aware of the impact of the parliamentary culture on female MPs. As a minister, she counselled those in her office in avoiding some of the pitfalls that ministerial staff often encounter. Kate Ellis left Parliament in 2019 so she could devote more time to her young family. She's now about to publish a book titled Sex, Lies and Question Time, for which she's interviewed women across the spectrum about their experiences in politics. Kate Ellis, you tweeted today that there's long existed a code of silence about the inner workings of Parliament House, and that the recent turfing aside of this in light of Brittany Higgins coming forward must be accompanied by real and meaningful change. But do you think that change is actually possible?
I know that change is possible. We've seen the world has changed. We've seen the private sector has had to change and adapt. We've actually seen the rest of society has changed, and I would argue much more successfully than the Parliament has. So if they've managed to do it, then there's certainly no reason I can see why we can't work to change the culture, to change the practices, and to bring the Parliament more in line with a modern Australia, particularly when it comes to the treatment of women.
Now, you spent a considerable time as an MP. What is it like to be a woman in the Parliament? What don't outsiders realise about it?
Well, I mean, I must say, I still to this day think that being a Member of Parliament is the best job in the world. I don't think there is any job that is more rewarding, more inspiring, with a greater ability to bring about change. But one of the things I have reflected upon is that there is no doubt that if you're a woman in our federal parliament, you are treated differently than if you're a man. This is a view that I hold because of my own experience, but it's a view that was only further entrenched when I myself went and interviewed women from across the parliament in a non-partisan way. Every single woman had a story to tell. Many had many stories to tell about how they were treated differently because they're a woman than their male colleagues are. And surely in 2021, that is something that should be a serious concern to all of us.
Now, these interviews were done for your book, that's right?
Correct.
Which is coming out soon, called Sex, Lies and Question Time, an intriguing title, I might say. What sort of things did you find in your own experience and in the experience of other women you've spoken to about this different treatment?
I think it very much varies from woman to woman. But, I mean, we've all seen examples. We've seen headlines in the last few years of, what is now termed slut-shaming in the federal parliament, where both Sarah Hanson-Young and Emma Hussar had court cases about that very treatment. We've seen a number of women talk about the way that rumours about their sex lives are weaponised in an attempt to undermine them in Parliament in a way that just doesn't happen to our male colleagues. But even to things that can seem more trivial, to the focus on female MPs' physical appearance is something that has been noted for a long time and is widespread, yet research shows is actually getting worse and not better. So there are a range of examples. And unfortunately, there's some new challenges which current MPs have to deal with that their predecessors didn't. And I would particularly give the example of social media. The research is overwhelming that women receive more abuse, more threats on social media. And that is also true for women in Parliament who rely upon social media as a way to communicate with their constituencies, but in doing so expose themselves to a potential level of harm that that previous generations didn't have to deal with. So I guess there's no one answer. There's no this is the one way women are treated differently. There is a vast array of different issues, different challenges, different barriers, which women mainly only have to deal with, and their male colleagues couldn't imagine having to deal with such challenges on a daily basis.
You went into Parliament when you were very young. You were often portrayed in the media as very glamorous. In 2008, the Courier Mail poll had you as Parliament's sexiest MP. How did you feel about this at the time? How did you deal with this at the time?
Well, I think at the time I tried to dismiss it as much as I could. I didn't want to draw more attention to that kind of reporting. But at the same time, I recognised that that wasn't helpful in terms of me trying to prove my credibility as a member of Parliament. You know, it wasn't helpful in terms of demonstrating that I was focused on policy development and better outcomes for Australians. And I guess what we do find is that's one example of if you have media space as a female MP that is dedicated to what you look like, then that's less media space that you're going to find available to talk about the message you're trying to get out. And it does make things harder, and it is something that women disproportionately deal with.
Claire O'Neill, who's currently a Labor MP here, has written this week about the damaging culture of male entitlement in Parliament. What's your view on this? Is Parliament just the most macho sort of workplace in Australia, do you think? Did you find this was your experience?
Well, obviously there are other workplaces which have significant challenges, so I don't know if I would rank it as the most. But there is no doubt that the culture of Parliament was established when it was set up by men, when the rules of engagement were set up by men, and it's still dominated by men. Even as we've worked to increase the number of female MPs there are, we still see that women are vastly underrepresented in the real power structures of the factions. They're underrepresented in senior staffing levels. So there's no doubt that men establish the culture in Parliament House. And that's why it's my firm belief that we talk about women needing to step up and change the culture. We actually need the men in Parliament to play a key role in that as well. They created it. It shouldn't be our job to fix it alone.
Now, of course, caucus has quota rules for the election of MPs, and caucus now has a very significant proportion of women in it. Has this changed the Labor Party culture, do you think?
I have absolutely no doubt about that. I mean, in the 15 years that I was a member of Parliament, I saw firsthand the number of female MPs around me increase, and I saw the impact that that had on culture. It's not just about having more women, although I do think when you have a critical mass, you have the confidence to stand up and demand change. You have the support structures, whether they're formal or informal. So it does play a really big role. But the other thing about the affirmative action rules that the Labor Party put in place, once our party adopted them, it meant that as a party, we prioritise gender equality. So it means that the attitudes of the men who have come through the party in that time, I think, have changed greatly as well. We have more men being elected on the Labor side who have equal relationships with their partners, who share the caring arrangements with their partners, who view things differently when it comes to gender relations than their predecessors one or two decades ago did. And I think that that progress is really obvious in the culture within the Labor Party. But, of course, we need to see that reflected across the whole Parliament.
Well, when it comes to positions or issues in the Labor Party, do you think women support women or do the women support their faction? Which comes first?
Well, I wish I could give you a quick answer to that. I think that people on the outside look at women in Parliament and say, why don't they just support each other more? What I've seen is that I think that when we increase the number of women on the Labor side, there's no question there was much more support. But in the conversations that I had with women across the parliament, it showed that if you're in a minor party and there's only a few women, then you may be set up to compete with those women internally for positions. And actually it can have a really negative impact on women's relationship with other women. Equally, I think when we look at the government and still see the underrepresentation of women, you do wonder how much those women feel like they have to compete to get one of the few spots. And personally, I also wonder how much those women feel like they have to remain silent on a whole range of issues and just count their blessings that they're lucky to have one of the few spots that is allocated for women and not rock the boat too much. Critical mass matters. In politics, nothing matters more than numbers, and that's true of the number of women as well.
But of course, the more women you have, the more there's going to be this competition between women, isn't there?
I just never found that to be my experience. I think that when you have enough women, there's no reason to automatically pit one woman against another. And I actually found that women across factions as well as within factions provided the most valuable support. I mean, I look at the role that Jenny Macklin played as a senior woman, looking out for all of us in the party, bringing us together, noticing when someone was upset or when something might be wrong. Tanya Plibersek's played a similar role. That is really invaluable, and it's something that I'm very, very grateful for.
Do you think that this whole issue of culture is discouraging women from entering parliament, from trying to run for pre-selections, from indeed joining parties?
I think there's two options at the moment. Women can look at the federal parliament and think, I don't want anything to do with that. I'm going to stay a long way away. What I hope is that women will make the other choice, that they'll get so angry that they'll want to march on parliament and get themselves elected so that they can get in there and help fix it. I do think the evidence shows that after Julia Gillard's experience and the treatment that she received when she was Australia's first female prime minister, that surveys of young Australian women showed that they were not interested in exposing themselves to a career in politics, and also that they believed that women were treated unfairly in Australian politics. So I think this is an issue that we haven't been talking about in the federal parliament overtly until recent months, but that Australian women have seen the treatment in the parliament. And I think now that we're having discussions and debates about it, it is a really good opportunity for us to try and inspire other women to actually get involved.
Looking back on the Gillard prime ministership, which obviously was marked by a lot of sexism, do you think that that was driven just by negative attitudes to a woman prime minister, or do you think it was also influenced by how she got there and other factors, political factors? In other words, was her gender weaponized against her for other reasons?
Yeah, I think there are a range of factors. And Julia herself says that you can't tell how much of the treatment is due to which factor. But there's no doubt that the way that she got the job played a role in her treatment, and that the toxic politics around action on climate change at the time played a role in that as well. But whatever inspired it, the way that she was attacked, the criticisms of her, the jokes that were made about her, they were done in a very gendered manner. And I think a lot of us were surprised. I think a lot of us knew that there was sexism that existed in parts of the community, but that when Julia became Prime Minister, it bubbled to the surface and exploded, and we saw it, and it wasn't just on the confines of social media. It was in the federal parliament. It was in the mainstream media. It was something that people were almost given a license to speak out about it because it was so widespread during that time. So, I mean, I think that Julia's experience as Prime Minister, a lot of women would have watched that and thought, why would I ever want to expose myself to anything like that? But equally, I think that the lessons that we've all been able to learn from that mean that I have no doubt it'll be easier for the next one and for the one that comes after that. So I think she's done us all a huge service, but, with some treatment that nobody should ever have to be subjected to.
Jennifer Westacott from the Business Council, I thought, made an interesting point the other day when she talked about the a sort of general culture of disrespect in Parliament House, and that sort of filters down to things like the treatment of women. Do you think there's something in that? For example, the politicians behave so badly in the House of Representatives every day in question time when they're not kept under total control by the Speaker. But is there sort of general bad behaviour about?
I think there's certainly. I think the rules of engagement in Parliament and in politics are a standard that would not be accepted in any other sort of industry or business. And I think it's more than just the MPs who are elected at any one time. I think it's the relationship with the media. I know when I was first elected, I was shocked when I saw that if you behave really badly in question time, but you humiliate someone on the other side effectively, or you make a joke at their expense and embarrass them, you often will be rewarded by getting the only grab that gets up on the TV news that night. So it actually encourages people. It makes for good viewing as opposed to making for a good work environment to be setting the tone for the rest of the country. So I do think it's a culture of the way that we engage politically with one another, the way that our question time is framed in particular, but I also think it's the role of the media and the way that they play a role in that, and there is a cycle of bad behaviour being rewarded.
Have they got worse, the media?
I think that, I don't know if the media's got worse. I think what's happened is that the view of politicians in the community's eyes has fallen greatly. There isn't the same level of respect and people looking up to their political leaders. So it's given the media license to go harder, and you know, to be tougher on politicians than they would previously. So I think it's just this spiral, sadly, that needs to be recognised and needs to be stopped. And I note that. I'm trying not to follow politics on a day-to-day basis now that I've secured my freedom, but I did notice in the last week or so, not only have we been having a debate about the treatment of women in Parliament House, but there's also been a debate about question time and recommendations on reforming question time. And I think you actually need to look at Parliament as a whole if you're going to achieve real and lasting change.
Of course, you could reform question time as a first principle by just the politicians behaving better, couldn't they?
Well, you could. But again, until politicians are either rewarded for behaving better or punished for behaving badly, I just don't see how that's going to change when, in fact, there is an incentive to behave badly at the moment. There's only a couple of areas where there's a bit of a unspoken convention that it's out of bounds when it comes to question time, and that is generally people try and not go after MPs or political opponents' family members or their staff members. But even with that, people try and push the boundaries on that all of the time. Imagine if we expanded that to you can't go after people's appearance, people's private lives, a whole range of things. We would lift the standards, you'd act more respectfully, the public would regard us better. And I suspect if the environment was improved, if the tone of Parliament House was improved, then the outcome in terms of the laws you're making for the whole country would be improved too. And I think that's certainly something that means this isn't just about what happens in Parliament House. It isn't just about whether, you know, life's tough for MPs or not. It's actually about how do we get the best laws and have the best representation for the Australian public. And in my mind, there is no question that needs serious reform.
Now, to go to the Brittany Higgins matter, how do you think this has been handled by the government?
Honestly, I can't get my head around the response. I've been thinking about this over the last few days, and I actually don't know what's worse. I don't know if it's worse if a staff member was allegedly raped in a minister's office, and if nobody thought that that was serious enough to take to the Prime Minister and alert him, then that is terrible in itself. On the other hand, if the Prime Minister did know about it but is then covering it up, that's terrible too. There's actually no There's no positive out of this at all, that the incredible bravery of that woman to come and speak out and tell the public, I think has been incredibly powerful in shining a light on just how bad the processes, the culture, and the reaction, in this case from the government, has been. It is inexcusable.
This matter, of course, was in the office of a female minister, Linda Reynolds, and she has said that Brittany Higgins decided she wouldn't go to the police or lay a formal complaint with the police. Brittany Higgins says that she felt it was a choice between her career and doing that. But if Linda Reynolds was asked to keep this private, should she have gone to the Prime Minister regardless?
Well, I think that what we've heard now is Brittany Higgins saying that she did not feel like she was supported. She did not feel like it was taken seriously, and she did not feel that she was given serious options. So I think that's what the real concern is there. I think that if there was a rape, a serious sexual assault, a crime of such a serious nature that took place in any workplace, then it might not be the personal details of those involved, but I think it would be normal practice for the leader of that workplace to be aware of it and to be able to make some serious changes to ensure it didn't happen again, but also to support the survivor of that. The fact that none of that happened is just unspeakable. I think it's appalling, and I have no words to think that the people who are in charge of laws, about laws against domestic violence, about awareness campaigns, about respectful relationships, the unspoken messages that the treatment of this case sends to the Australian public about how serious they take those issues is just devastating.
Now, you were a minister for a number of years, running a ministerial office. A lot of these problems, of course, involve ministerial offices, a lot of the parliamentary culture problems. Did you ever have any serious staff issues within your office? And how did you run that office to stop problems arising?
Yeah, I didn't have serious issues within my office, but what I did have, and I was just speaking with one of my former staff members to say, because of the unusual environment of Canberra politics, I mean, it means that people are almost away. There's like a school camp feel to it. People are going out at nights a lot, particularly staff members going out a lot, that I found it quite confronting because I overstepped the line of an employer on several occasions. There were several occasions when I would sit my staff member down and actually play more of a maternal role than anything else, kind of talking about the culture, making sure that they were okay, making sure that they knew that they could come to me. Now, that's not the traditional role of an employer. Normally what people do outside of their strict work hours is up to them. But just having seen enough of the Canberra culture, I felt that it was my responsibility to play that role, and it's something that I did on a number of occasions.
So what do you mean? You told them not to go out so much or not to drink so much?
I wouldn't tell them not to go out, but I'd certainly give them warnings about the culture, about the way some people partied and behaved, and about particularly the fears that I had about power imbalances for young female staff is something that I spoke to my staff about on a number of occasions.
You mean power imbalances within the office among colleagues?
It's not just within people's direct office. You know, from the Four Corners story that we saw last year, it's not necessarily about what's happening within one office, that there is a power imbalance if you are a young female staffer. And any minister or MP from across the government, you know, potentially has the power to play a role in your future career, has the power to block future promotions or put in place opposition to your own pre-selection. This is really serious power imbalances which happen, and it means that when you've got that power imbalance at the same time that you might have people, and I'm not talking about the kind of illegal activity that's been reported in recent days, but I'm talking about people making propositions, hitting on other people. It's really dangerous when there are those power imbalances, and it's something that I think everyone involved needs to be very conscious of.
And how did the staff react?
Oh, I think they probably reacted the same way I used to react when I got maternal talks from my mother and say, yes, yes. But no, I think, you know, I have an ongoing friendship with my staff, and I've tried to play a role in mentoring, particularly female, but not just female staff. So I think those relationships are really important, but they are different in Canberra than probably in any other parliament house, where it doesn't have the same dynamic of people being away from home so often. It's something that is unique to Canberra's political atmosphere, and something that I think everybody needs to be really conscious of.
Now, just finally, you said being an MP is the greatest job in the world, but you also mentioned gaining your freedom. I wonder how you feel now after a couple of years out of the madhouse, whether you have any regrets or whether you think life outside is really liberation.
Well, a bit of both. You know, I made a decision about what was best for me in trying to balance a job I loved with a family I loved, and how lucky am I to have that problem. I made the right decision for me. I don't question that. But I do miss, you know, it's hard to replace, you know, being able to bring about change, policy development. You can literally change people's lives more in certainly one term of government than you can in a lifetime of working in most other jobs. And I'm really conscious of that. I gave up something that I loved, but it wasn't working for me. And I think that what should form part of this discussion is also a way that we modernise the parliament so that people can better balance their work and caring responsibilities. I think there are endless options and possibilities that we could adopt if people were serious about recognising that if you want a parliament that's made up to look like the community it represents, then it has to include parents of young children. It has to include people with caring responsibilities of their elderly parents, or people with health issues, or people with disability. There are a range of people who are still excluded from our parliament, and that is something that we need to look at.
Kate Ellis, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us today, and looking back on parliament and making observations also about how it's operating now. That's all for today's Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.